The nonviolent resistors can summarize our message in the following simple terms. We will take direct action against injustice. Despite the failure of governmental and other official agencies to act first, we will not obey unjust laws or submit to unjust practices. We will do this peacefully, openly, cheerfully, because our aim is to persuade. We adopt the means of nonviolence because our end is a community at peace with itself. We will try to persuade with our words. But if our words fail, we will try to persuade with our acts. We will always be willing to talk and seek fair compromise, but we are ready to suffer when necessary and even risk our lives in order to become witnesses to truth as we see it. This approach to the problem is not at all without successful precedent. It was used in a magnificent way by Mohandas K. Gandhi to challenge the might of the British Empire and free his people from the political domination and economic exploitation inflicted upon them for centuries. He struggled only with the weapons of truth, soul force, non-injury and courage.
Hello and welcome to Loopholes. I'm Chris Albanati.
And I'm Jay Mitchie.
And you're tuned into CFBX 92.5 on your FM dial, www.thex.ca if you're tuned in live stream over the web. Today's show is pre-recorded. We're going to talk a little bit about the Donald Marshall Jr. Case, something we just covered in class, and something that might be fitting for the time right now. So, but first, Jay's signaling towards me that we have important local business to attend to, the issue of the Kamloops civic election. Jay.
That's right. Beep, 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 beep. This just in. Kamloops has elected a new city council. Not entirely new. We got the same mayor. We got four returning faces to city council.
Excellent.
And we got four new faces to city council.
Oh. So it's a good split.
A little bit of a mix-up.
Yeah.
I was not able to vote when we talked about this.
Nor was I.
No. I'm an Albertan. You're
still a Quebecer, I guess.
Still a Quebecer by virtue of Alberta. Wait, that doesn't come across.
I was an Albertan.
Right.
I was born in Winnipeg, actually.
The important part here, the salient detail, is that neither one of us were able to vote.
Correct.
I went and looked at the polling booth, like a kid who's not allowed to play hockey.
You lived vicariously
through all the other people showing up to exercise their civic duty. I'll have you know, Chris, that was the first time ever in my life I have not voted.
Really?
Since I was old enough to vote.
Hmm. Wow. Actually, I think I voted at every election since I was 18 as well. Yeah. Student, politics, all of the things. I always exercise my right.
Damn rights.
If you don't exercise, you lose it. And that goes for rights and physical capabilities.
Right. And as it turns out, though, no candidate lost by one vote. So I can rest comfortable knowing that even though I was excluded from this voting process, it didn't have a material effect on the outcome of the election, although it was a close election. Peter Milibar,
yeah.
Mayor Peter Milibar, his worship, is that what they call him?
Maybe. In Calgary, it's his worship.
That's right. And other places, too, but Calgary's particularly weird about that. Anyways, Peter Milibar has been returned to the mayor's chair. He won by a very small margin, 235 votes, is what CFJC has reported. I'm going by their website here. Mm-hmm. And against his primary challenger, Dieter Duty, local businessman Dieter Duty. Were you not ready for that, Chris?
No, I wasn't. I'm sorry. As someone who's only lived here for about almost 3 months now, I was not prepared for I haven't stayed on top of my electoral candidates, and I did not know that one of them was named Dieter Duty.
Dieter Duty is a local businessman from, I believe he's got some kind of farm operation in Westside. He's involved in the farmer's market and is a producer of food. Anyways, and a popular guy enough to get 9,100 votes and wow. change. Yeah. And almost take the mayor's chair. So he ran a formidable campaign, it can be easily said. So in the end, Peter Milibar took it. He remains the mayor of Kamloops.
Great.
We had four councillor candidates. Former councillors who were returned to council. I'm sorry if I get any of these names wrong. They're actually quite straightforward names, but you never know. Tina Lang, Pat Wallace, Nancy Beppel, and Marge Spina. I'm sure I got at least one of those wrong.
Spina.
Yeah, who knows? Anyways, there all of those good folks were returned to council, and four new names: Ken Christensen, Donovan Cavers. I think it's Cavers. Arjun Singh and Nellie Denver. Now, Arjun Singh, I know, is not entirely new. He was on council from 2005 to 2008, but he is back. I think he's if I'm not mistaken, he's the only councillor from the North Shore.
Wow!
So that's important.
Excellent.
If somebody wants to correct me on that, they can certainly do that. But to the best of my knowledge, he is the only councillor from the North Shore, from the other side of the river, and. Donovan Cavers is an interesting character. I have to point him out here. He's a young fellow, about my age, I guess. Put him at maybe somewhere in the 25 to 30 range. Very active guy. He ran in the last federal election for the Green Party. Huh? Got over 3,000 votes that time, so that probably helped him this mm-hmm. time around.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure it's safe to say that he's the youngest member on council. So I met him a couple weeks ago. Very nice fellow. Had I been able to vote, probably would have voted for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Anyways, he didn't need my
vote.
Catches your eye. He got on there anyways. A couple of other very worthy candidates out there did not get elected this time around. That happens sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I express my condolence to them, but that's the process. So there it is. Election wrap up.
Jay, I must applaud you. I must commend you on only being a resident here for roughly the same period as me, and you do your homework. You know your civic politics.
When it comes to municipal politics, man,
you're in there like swimwear.
That's right. That's my thing.
Excellent. Well, if we
if we just completely just hack job that to pieces.
I don't see how we could have.
Let us know.
That was pretty strict.
Yeah.
Election results.
I think it was pretty good. So.
But
every 3 years they get elected?
I think so. Usually that's how municipal elections work.
Right.
3 year terms.
So I will be able to vote the next time around. So.
You'll be running. I have a feeling Jay Mitchie might be running. This will be my guess.
To all you who I read your name, better be warned.
That Jay Mitchie is coming to take your seat. Especially you, Milibar.
That's not necessarily true.
He takes local issues to heart. He is a man of the community. He is compassionate. He works tirelessly for the underdog.
We're talking about Peter Milibar still, right?
Well, I'm talking about mayoral candidate 2014, Jay Mitchie. That is my call, anyways.
We'll
see.
Honored,
we'll see. We'll look back on this episode 3 years from now and go, see, I told you so.
Well.
Dreams to think about. All right. On to different topics of different levity today. We're going to talk about the Donald Marshall Jr. case.
Levity.
Okay. Yeah, different degrees of levity. Certainly this is not as, I don't even know what the...
No, there's nothing lovable. Lovable?
Yeah. I don't know.
This might as well be live.
Let's go to a musical break, and we'll come back with a more somber tone to prepare us for the topic we're about to discuss today.
Right.
Stay tuned. You're listening to CFBX 92.5 on your FM dial, www.thex.ca over the web. This is Loopholes. See you in a few. If your love's still strong.
Good evening. A report released today suggests that justice was not blind, was not always fair in Nova Scotia. The report is the result of almost 3 years' work by a royal commission which investigated the Donald Marshall case. And it paints a disturbing portrait of the system which convicted the Mi'kmaq Indian for a crime he never committed. The report says racism and incompetence helped put Marshall behind bars and helped keep him there for 11 years. Susan Armiston reports.
19 years after Donald Marshall was wrongly jailed, an inquiry vindicates him.
At long last, one Donald Marshall Jr. will stand high in the eyes of Nova Scotians where he deserves to stand.
The inquiry judges conclude Donald Marshall was a victim, wrongly convicted in part because he's an Indian. Their report says, "We're convinced if Marshall had been white, the investigation would have taken a different course." From the moment the young Mi'kmaq was arrested, the judges say prejudice tainted the way he was treated. Sydney's chief of police at the time, John McIntyre, is accused of fingering Marshall because he thought he was a troublesome Indian. That was just the beginning. The report says incompetent police and legal work and disinterest in the Justice Department kept an innocent man in jail for 11 years. Then, as he was finally released, Nova Scotia's highest court added insult to injury. The appeal court said Marshall was partly to blame for his conviction. The commissioners called that conclusion extraordinary, saying it amounted to a defense of the criminal justice system at Marshall's expense, in spite of overwhelming evidence that the system itself had failed.
The inquiry also contrasted the treatment Donald Marshall got with that of two Nova Scotia cabinet ministers who were investigated by police. The report points out that Nova Scotia practiced two types of law, one for those with influence and another for Donald Marshall.
The report says officials in the Attorney General's department are more concerned about the career of a politician than the reputation of an Indian. Donald Marshall himself avoided publicity today, saying he's tired of all the exposure. But his lawyer says the inquiry has finally set the record straight.
I think he feels better. And I think that he sees now that it has been accepted officially that the blame belongs elsewhere other than with him.
And in Cape Breton, Marshall's mother says she's relieved it's finally over.
I want to thank God, my son came out one piece.
The inquiry urges some major changes in Nova Scotia's justice system, improved race relations, and better police work in the province. It also recommends that a native criminal court system be set up on Nova Scotia reserves. In all, there are more than 80 recommendations, an indication of just how much needs to be done. Susan Ormiston, CBC News, Halifax.
All right, and welcome back. That was a clip from 1990, a CBC clip. That was Susan Ormiston reporting. This goes back to the case of Donald Marshall Jr., which is what we're going to be talking about today, for no other reason than that it is taking up a bulk of what we're talking about this week in our law classes.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about wrongful convictions. And there are lots of great, not great, I shouldn't say they're great. There are a lot of iconic wrongful conviction cases in Canadian history, far too many, it could be said. I just said it. But this one stands out because, of course, it also has undertones of elements of race.
Deep-seated racism, I would say.
That's a better way of putting it. That pervaded the entire case, going from his original conviction in 1971 to his appeal in 1982, which released him from prison, although not in the best circumstances, and then ultimately culminated in a royal commission which investigated his arrest, conviction, detainment, and appeal, all in the scope of systemic racism in the Canadian justice system.
Yeah, the criminal justice system specifically. Yeah, the commission was appointed by the Nova Scotia government in 1986, and it released its 7-volume. It's something like 9,000 pages, or maybe more. Maybe it's 18,000. It's some incredible amount of pages. 7 volumes on this report. It was released in 1989. Now, I guess maybe we should just back up and talk about the facts of the case, starting off with, what was Donald Marshall Jr. convicted of?
Well, yeah, it goes back to the night of May 28th, 1971, and Donald Marshall Jr. was in the company at that point with Sanford Williams, known as Sandy Seal. Mm-hmm. He becomes the, unfortunately became the victim in this case.
Yeah.
They were together. They had been involved in an altercation with two other men, and ultimately resulting in the stabbing and death of Sandy Seeley. There was an investigation that followed, where quickly Donald Marshall Jr. became the prime suspect. The investigating detective at the time was a fellow by the name of... I'll never find it now.
McIntyre.
McIntyre was his name, yeah. I can't remember his first name.
Sergeant of Detectives.
Yeah, and he came to the quick conclusion that Donald Marshall Jr. was responsible for the murder and proceeded to investigate along those lines. He had two young offenders who had earlier on in the evening been with Donald Marshall Jr. and Mr. Seeley, and he used their testimonies. He solicited testimony from them to color the case against Donald Marshall Jr.
Color is quite the word to use.
Yeah. So that's what happened. Went to court. Unfortunately, the Crown prosecutors at the time did not do a complete thorough investigation. They also didn't provide full disclosure to the defense.
Yeah, there were several things wrong with the case. First of all, the trial lasted only 3 days. Just like that. Not only did the Sergeant of Detectives, Mr. McIntyre, approach the case and investigate it with a complete predisposition towards Marshall's guiltiness, but there were conflicting statements from the two key witnesses in the case that provided the most incriminating evidence towards Donald Marshall Jr.'s, conviction. The Crown prosecutor was aware of conflicting statements in the
from these young men.
And
one was 16, one was 15.
14. 14, 16. Whatever. Facts aren't irrelevant. But in any case, so the point of the case was that at every turn, these points of justice had failed Donald Marshall Jr. And the Royal Commission, released in 1989, speaks to systemic racism.
We can't jump to the Royal Commission yet.
No?
No.
Okay.
No, first we need to talk about the fact that the Crown prosecutor failed, the defense failed, and...
Let's go to the Crown then. How did the Crown fail?
So the Crown failed, as you said, to be able to provide full disclosure to the... They were aware that there was conflicting testimony, that, in fact, one of the fellow who had been with this other group that Donald Marshall Jr. and his and the victim, Sandy Seeley, later testified that he was pretty sure that his buddy had killed Sandy Seeley, not Donald Marshall Jr. This was disregarded.
Yeah.
This was not provided to the defense. And then, of course, the defense counsel, these were two
high-standing.
Yeah, well-respected members of the legal community in Halifax, didn't actually go to any length to try and obtain evidence from the Crown, and that there's some other anecdotal evidence that says that maybe they just didn't care that much, that they actually believed that their own client was guilty, mm-hmm. and that they also didn't tend to spend as much time on the cases of their Aboriginal clients as they did with their non-Aboriginal clients.
Yes, yes.
So that was a major problem. Yeah. So we've got the police who are doing kind of a sloppy job, well, extremely sloppy mm-hmm. job, if not overtly
racist
and negligent. They just did a really bad job. Then we've got the Crown doing a bad job. We've got his defense doing a bad job. And of course, the jury's going to lock him up.
But we've missed the trial judge. And actually, the trial judge culminates in all of these failings, where he makes various incorrect rulings on evidence during the trial, and comes down to the fact that he well, basically did not give Marshall a fair trial. I think that's obvious, but he allows the use of hearsay evidence. He allows an improper reference to a tattoo on Marshall's arm that was visible at the time that read, "I hate cops." Even though it had nothing to do with the case in point, he allowed the Crown to bring that forward in order to sort of paint him in a certain light in front of the jury.
He was actually the one that said it.
Yeah, and he was the one. Yeah, the Crown didn't even bring it.
No, the judge pointed it out to the jury.
Pointed out, oh, look at this guy's arm.
And another thing. Yeah.
If I may. He also allowed the parents of Seal to be called as witnesses, to what extent were they witnesses? They weren't there at the scene of the crime. We're not experts in evidence, you and I, but clearly that seems to be wrong. Merely in a plea to provoke sympathy in the jurors. So, a lot of things. I will jump to the commission just for a second, just to quote something. Actually, no, I won't jump to that. He says actually, there was some contesting of his improperly limiting the cross examination of the key witnesses in regards to their conflicting statements. And in his judgment, he actually says, to quote, "Whether I am right, who is there in this world who can say that he never made mistakes is a matter which may, if necessary, be looked into at some future time." Kind of ironic words for the 1971 trial.
That was the trial judge.
Yeah, that was the trial judge saying that. So in light of the commission and the fallout that would happen, it is somewhat ironic.
So then Donald Marshall Jr. is taken into custody. He is at that point... he's taken to a transfer facility where he spends a year waiting for to be sent to an actual prison.
Yeah,
he's eventually transferred to Dorchester Penitentiary, which is, I don't know my Nova Scotia geography, but apparently it's like a 6-hour drive from Halifax. Mm-hmm. It's very remote.
Picture the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, very old, very ancient fortress-like jail where he is given the whole delousing treatment and slammed away, and that's it. He's gone for 11 years, 10 years after that.
Yeah.
And so during this time...
Wait. He did have an appeal in 1972. There was an appeal. It was dismissed.
It was a matter of course.
Yes.
Yeah, it was not a traditional appeal in the sense that something wrong happened here. We need to appeal it. It was a matter of procedure. Yes. Anyways.
Right.
He's gone till 1982, at which point there is... new evidence comes forward, and on a referral from the then Justice Minister, Federal Justice Minister, the Honorable Jean Chrétien, the Nova Scotia Supreme Court Appellate Division is required to review the case again. Mm-hmm. At this point, it's become obvious that, in fact, this other guy, Ebsery, mm-hmm. who was the one who had committed the murder... So they had to go through this process, and basically it was a painful process for the appellate court because, in fact, one of the members of the appellate court had been the former Attorney General of Nova Scotia at the original time of his conviction in 1971.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they had to review this case in light of the fact that they had actually committed this man to prison wrongfully,
mm-hmm.
And it was awkward for them, and in the end they ended up saying some very troubling things.
Yeah, but just before we get to that, I want to do two things. One is point out how exactly that case got to the 1983 reference, and there's a very actually technical process for it, and it's actually codified now. It was a different code back in 1982, but today the code is sections 696.1 to 696.6 of the criminal code, which basically allows for an application for the mercy of the Crown. We talked a little bit about that. Oh. Anyways, the applications for ministerial review on a miscarriage of justice basically allows for the Minister of Justice to... when a person's appeals have been exhausted, this is a definition here, the ability of the Minister of Justice to order a new trial or appeal if... and quote, "there is a reasonable basis to conclude that a miscarriage of justice is likely occurred." So that is actually how it got there, because usually after your appeals, you've exhausted your chances, so to speak. So that's how it got there in 1983. And the outcome of the 1983 reference, we will get to after the musical break.
Sure.
All right. Let's take a quick break, have a song, and we'll get back to it. You're listening to
Loopholes on CFBX 92.5 FM.
Back in a...
On the X.
Back in a bit. And welcome back. You're listening to Loopholes on CFBX 92.5 FM, Kamloops Alternative Radio. It's superior radio.
Thompson River University's very own legal, law, politics, society, talk radio show with music.
With Jay.
And Chris.
And we're good to be back. So we're about halfway through the show. We wanted to, of course, do our public service and tell you a little bit about what's happening around town. Jay, why don't you kick it off? You've got a real good one there.
Yeah, The Art We Are hosts Open Heart Mondays twice per month on, yes, Mondays from 7 to 11 p.m. Lord Byron said that letter writing is the only device for combining solitude with good company. And these evenings are set aside for the creation of works of handwritten art in a relaxed atmosphere. All supplies are by donation or can be brought along by participants, and gifts of stationery are most welcome. Stamps are available at Canada Post prices, and The Art We Are will mail your letter for you. The next session is November 28th.
Well, the Kamloops Heritage Radio, or sorry, the Kamloops Heritage Railway Society, KHRS, is hosting its first annual Steam Back to History Gala and auction at MacArthur Island Sports Center on Friday, December 2nd. The event will take a look at the city's railway history and also raise funds to help the society to maintain its railway equipment and finance its community projects and profile. Happy hour gets underway at 5:30 p.m. The buffet dinner is served at 6:30 p.m. and the evening will include entertainment, silent auctions, and door prizes. Individual tickets are $80 each and two for $150. Tables of eight are available for $600 or a VIP table for eight for $700. A tax-deductible receipt for $35 is issued per person. For tickets and information, contact Sally at 250-374-2141 or by email at gm@kamrail.com. That's Sally at 250-374-2141. Be sure to say hi. All right, on to Donald Marshall Jr. and the 1983 reference, which was appointed by Minister of Justice at the time, the Honorable Jean Chrétien.
I remember him.
I remember him.
Oh no.
Oh no. Not another. I grew up listening to very bad Alberta impersonations of Jean Chrétien. It's terrible. People seem to enjoy
it. Should have just kept it to air parts, man.
Yeah, yeah. Just leave it.
Anyways,
leave it there.
What happens in this appeal? Obviously, they find that they get this fellow, James McNeil, who was with the actual perpetrator of the crime, of the murder. He gives a rather complete testimony at the appeal, where it becomes obvious that, in fact, this Roy Ebsrie fellow had committed the crime, not Donald Marshall Jr. I'm actually going to read from the judgment, because I think it's important. We had it word for word. We've been kind of paraphrasing quite a bit here. So this was coming from the court. They say, Donald Marshall Jr. was convicted of murder and served a lengthy period of incarceration. That conviction is now to be set aside. Any miscarriage of justice, however, is more apparent than real. In attempting to defend himself against the charge of murder, Mr. Marshall admittedly committed perjury for which he still could be charged. By lying, he helped secure his own conviction. He misled his lawyers and presented to the jury a version of the facts he now says is false. A version that was so far-fetched as to be incapable of belief. By planning a robbery with the aid of Mr. Seeley, he triggered a series of events which unfortunately ended in the death of Mr. Seeley. By hiding the facts from his lawyers and police, Mr. Marshall effectively prevented the development of the only defense available to him, namely, that during a robbery, Seeley was stabbed by one of the intended victims. He now says that he knew approximately where the man lived who stabbed Seeley, and he had a pretty good description of him. With this information, the truth of the matter might well have been uncovered by the police.
Absolutely.
So that, when the first time I read that, to be honest, I thought nothing of it. I thought, oh, well, I mean, I guess the guy's not guilty of murder. That's pretty good.
That's nice. You're free to go.
Yeah, better than a kick in the head. Then again, after 11 years in prison, you know, you have to think about this. You're now being told that you didn't do it, but it was still sort of your fault.
Yeah, but in fact, it was all your fault.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what they're saying? And I know we've sort of been paraphrasing and weaving the commission's report in and out of these things. So, but while we hear those exact words, I wanted to read basically the thrust of, or the what the commission said about that, their words. The thrust of the Court of Appeals' gratuitous comments in the last two pages of the judgment is to pin the blame on Marshall for his conviction and to ignore any evidence which would suggest fault on the part of the criminal justice system. The decision amounted to a defense of the system at Marshall's expense. And they slammed the 1983 reference. Would you agree?
That's right. Yeah, they look at the facts. They go over the factual findings. They develop an entirely different, after they spent a year investigating this. Mm-hmm. So after a year of investigating, they come up with an entirely different construction of the facts than even the appeal court did. They look very carefully at the police investigation and have some very damning words to say about the police investigation. Also, the trial process itself, the role of the Crown Prosecutor, the lackluster performance of the defense counsel, the trial judge, and the things that he said that exacerbated the situation, the 1972 appeal, the correctional system, and this is one of the points that I found really interesting, the commentary that even after he was released, the injustice continued to happen because he wasn't afforded any of the benefits of the system that an offender might have upon release of prison, the halfway house measures, being afforded a parole officer, these types of things, right? So he had actually no institutional support when he came out. The point that the Royal Commission makes is that he, even though that's not particularly the fault of the correction system, because they have no ability to actually assist people who are not guilty, but that it is symbolic of the failing of the system in general. They said the system is simply not set up to deal with the unique situation in which Marshall found himself. While it's understandable, it is nonetheless difficult to imagine a more tragic circumstance. So, yeah, it is restorative reading the entire Royal Commission report. I read these in completely the wrong sequence, like I told you, Chris.
Yeah.
I read the appeal first, And then I had to figure out what happened originally. So I went back and read the 1971 mm-hmm. case. And so I'm kind of convinced that this guy actually did, you know, if he didn't do it, at least he contributed to his own guilt.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then once you realize what happened, after you realize, once you read the Royal Commission's report, you realize that a travesty of justice did take place here and that it actually continued to take place after his release.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe we could maybe talk a bit about the what happened to Donald Marshall Jr. following all of this.
Well, he certainly was an outspoken Aboriginal rights activist. I don't know much about Donald Marshall Jr. after his release, though. I know that he was involved in a very landmark fishing
case. So in late 90s that he did actually start to take on a more of a more prominent role in Canadian society. He was out there and he had reluctance about talking about his situation. He said, I've had enough of it. I don't want to be at the center of spotlight. But after a few years, he did start coming out and he did start acting as an advocate. And in 1999, it came to a culmination. He managed to get all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada on Mi'kmaq fishing rights,
yeah.
Reinforcing their treaty rights, which is kind of a sidebar story to this.
A vindication, if you will.
Yeah, but he did have trouble throughout his life. He continued to experience trouble as a result of the experience that he had undergone from the time he was 17 to the time he was 28. And in 2006, he was actually involved in a violent altercation with another fellow. Actually, good way to put about this. He tried to drive over a guy with his truck.
Yeah, it was allegedly or not allegedly maybe, but he was.
He did.
He was said to be trying to attempted murder. He took
responsibility for that, and it was actually all dealt with. It was diverted from the criminal court system. And it was handled through a sentencing circle.
A healing circle, actually.
A healing circle,
probably the more appropriate. But yeah, no, I found that neat when reading that story, and you and me, we're both the same in the sense we get off on huge research tangents when we're studying these things, and
that's
we
right.
take one name, and then we spend 2 hours researching who this person was, what they did, who their family was. Interesting enough, side note, that usually when I do that, things end up reverting back to Pierre Trudeau somehow. So usually I end up reading something new about Pierre Trudeau in those research tangents. But in relation to this, yeah, I mean, I think it's neat just in reflecting on what we talked about last week, that he... his own offense, this very violent thing in 2006, was dealt with in a restorative justice circle or a restorative justice process and had a very favorable outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, again, you look at this, you can look at this very cynically and say, he was trying to drive over a guy with his truck, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the kind of guy, maybe he did commit that murder back in 1971. But that is not the way to really look at the situation. Donald Marshall Jr. suffered substance abuse problems. It led to a breakdown in a number of relationships. His life was dramatically affected by his wrongful conviction back in 1971. And I think it's clear once you've read everything that the tragedy that happened in 2006, nobody actually died, thankfully, but that was actually a byproduct of all the things that had happened to him back in the 1970s,
yeah.
And 1980s.
And it's an incredible story, the story of Donald Marshall Jr. He's since passed away in 2009.
Yeah.
And the Mi'kmaq band actually had a marble statue carved of him, which is in Nova Scotia now. I think there's a picture of it on the internet I've seen.
You got farther in your investigation than I did.
Yes, I got to that point.
Get to the marble statue.
But before we leave the commission, I just want to talk, because there are two parts. One, they did all this investigation, and they located and pointed out very categorically these extreme failings of the system, the criminal justice system, and at how at every turn they led implicitly to the wrongful conviction of Donald Marshall Jr. And this... I mean, there have been dozens of wrongful convictions in Canada's criminal history, and all of them are tragic stories similar to this one. And so I think this commission, in some respects, in their second part, released some ideas, some policy ideas that could be implemented to dealing with this kind of systemic problem? And these are questions that sort of they raised, and some of the things that they said about it in terms of visible minorities in the criminal justice system, and in terms of dealing with wrongfully convicted. So they started off by asking the question, how should society deal with situations in which people are convicted and jailed for crimes they did not commit? They also ask, how do we make sure we find out about such situations? And once we have learned about them, how do we determine a fair method to compensate those who have been the victims of such injustices? To their questions, they suggested an independent review mechanism needed to be established to deal with the allegations of wrongfully convicted. They also needed to be independent, for sure, so that those with information will be willing to come forward, as they alluded to that this problem was systemic in the entire criminal justice system. So independence was key, and in order to be effective, it needed to have investigative powers to look into the allegations and obtain access to all relevant information and interview all witnesses. Now, I'd scoured the web. Speaking of research senses, I scoured the web for this independent mechanism or body, and I didn't find anything, which says to me, and given that there are still wrongful convictions to this day, which says to me that no such mechanism was put in place. Did you see any mechanism?
Well, we did come across the fact that there is such a group in, such an organization, such a body, regulatory body in the United Kingdom, yes, that reviews cases of potential wrongful conviction. Mm-hmm. And since they were created some 15 years ago, they've heard 12,000 or so cases. Mm-hmm. Of the 12,000 cases that they've heard, they have, of 12,000 cases that have been brought to them, they've actually investigated 400. Can't investigate all of them. They investigated 400, and I think 285 of them or something like that were overturned.
Wow.
115 of them they've decided probably not enough here to overturn it.
Yeah.
But so yeah, in the United Kingdom they have a body doing that. In the United States they have Dog the Bounty Hunter. I'm not sure what we have in Canada.
Well, I mean, see, I think the point of this commission was saying that Canada needs to recognize this systemic problem in their own criminal justice system, and that the government should have a responsibility to establish an independent mechanism. But failing to see or find the existence of one such body, we do have the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted, and it's basically a fully volunteer operation, and they do take on cases.
And the Minister of Justice still retains the right to review your case.
Yes, at the mercy of the Crown.
Yeah.
So there are some options, but I don't know if the remedies quite meet the bar that the Commission was expecting.
Yeah.
As to the case of visible minorities and the criminal justice system, they said the Attorney General should adopt a policy on race relations based on a commitment to employment equity and elimination of inequalities based on race. They also said to ensure more minorities get to participate in the justice system as Crown Counsel, as justices, as defense criminal lawyers. The Government of Canada, Nova Scotia, as well as the Canadian Bar Association, as well, and the law schools should financially support new special minority admissions programs. So I think a lot of those have come into place. But one thing I noticed, and maybe this is just me, is that they really wanted the government to focus on appointing visible minority judges wherever possible. And the thing I find interesting is that, and you can look this up on the Supreme Court of Canada website, you can take a look at every single picture of every justice that's ever sat on the Supreme Court of Canada. And I couldn't find a single visible minority.
Right. Well, there really hasn't been any visible minorities. But actually, that ties into a story I read in the Globe and Mail yesterday. Somewhat related, talking about the diminishing numbers of female judges being appointed to the federal bench.
Mm.
It says, I read from the Globe and Mail here, the appointment of female judges has diminished to a trickle under the Harper government, dashing any hopes that equal gender representation is on the doorstep. Only 8 women have been appointed to the federal judiciary this year, compared to 41 men. As of last year, 13 women were appointed, as opposed to 37 men being given judgeships. And that brings the total now of female judges on, these are federal judges, 356 female judges amongst a total of 1,117 judges and the number is now going down. The proportion of women on the bench is going down. So not only are visible minorities not being appointed to the bench, but women are actually are losing their proportionality on the bench.
Right. Oh yeah, and also, I mean, not those aggregate facts in and of themselves speak to an issue of equity on that range, but it's always been said that there's another systemic problem of people being appointed to the bench or people involved in these areas of the justice system in general, in that they generally come from a class. I think this was mentioned at the very start of the year and talked about at length by some of our professors, that there is this question of, you know, people who, common law is judge-made law, and the judges are generally white males from upper and middle classes, and that goes without saying that...
What's the saying? It's white laws for... No, I won't get it right. No, I'm just messing it up.
If you know it, email us, yeah. tru.loopholes@gmail.com.
That's sorry, Chris. Justice for, by, and about white men.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about this actually in another class, one of our readings on sort of gender in the criminal law, and it says the criminal law has traditionally taken a gender blind approach, and this speaks a lot to the fact that it was mainly written by white males, and criminal law does not exist in a vacuum and is informed by the dominant social values of its time. So, in thinking about the criminal law, I guess you could keep that in mind, that the laws we have today were essentially formed by a very different time.
I've got that quote here that I was going to share with you. That was from M.L. Friedland.
Okay.
And it's this was stated in the trials of Israel Lipsky back in 1984. A trial may in theory be an objective pursuit of truth, but in practice there are many subjective factors which influence the course of events. Justice may in theory be blind, but in practice she has altogether too human a perspective. I like how he said she.
She, yeah. Lady Justice.
Lady Justice. Right.
Yep. In relation to...
Still expecting a white guy with a mustache.
Speaking of mustaches, your mustache is coming in very nicely.
Thanks, Chris. You too.
I think I was saying this the other day that it suits you, the mustache. You always wear a fedora. You're always seen adorned with a bel chapeau, and the mustache is a perfect complement to it.
It is scary.
Scary in a way, yeah. Anyways, let's have another song, and we'll come back and wrap this show up after the break. Thank you. Welcome back to the show. This is Loopholes, a somber episode talking about Donald Marshall Jr. And an issue of systemic problems in the criminal justice system in reference to wrongful convictions, which a wrongful conviction is basically the ultimate failing of the criminal justice system. When somebody, it's been said that it has a two-pronged, it's a two-pronged failing. Not only does a person get incarcerated wrongfully, but the person who actually committed the crime is set free, or is continued to allowed to be free. So a two-pronged failing of the criminal justice system. We're almost out of time, but we, as promised, have a Latin segment for you. But before that, let's do our public service one more time and get to this. I've got one here. Arnica Artists Run Center hosts its upcoming annual fundraiser, Winter Celebration Show and Sale, at the Old Courthouse Cultural Center, 7 West Seymour Street through December 23rd. The event brings together a diverse range of new work created by local artists, from painting, printing, and photography to sculpture, ceramics, and jewelry. Everyone is welcome to attend, and all work is for sale. Center hours are Tuesday to Friday, 10 to 5, and Saturday, 10 to 4. And more information is available by calling Kelly at 250-372-2611.
Barb's used Book and Music Sale, the hugely successful annual fundraising event for the Kamloops Symphony, is now on at its traditional 5,000-square-foot space in the Sahali Center Mall. The event will continue daily through to Saturday, November 26th, operating during regular mall hours, and offers a huge range of quality used books, sheet music, movies on tape and DVD, vinyl records, and CDs of music. Many items are priced at only $2 each, and donations of all things literary and musical are gladly accepted at the sale. For more information, contact Kathy at the KSO office at 250-372-5000.
Excellent. All right. Well, cue the music. NJ, what is the Latin word for today?
That's right. We didn't do it last week. We kind of just missed it. So we made sure we had a good one for you today. It's a word phrase again, not just a word. Ready?
I'm ready. Ready and waiting.
In flagrante delicto.
Which means?
caught in the very act of committing the crime. So it's actually doesn't actually have a direct translation into English. It's can be used in a couple different ways, but it is usually meant to describe being caught red-handed, or a blazing metaphor. In flagrante delicto, also the title of, I'm told, of a Marilyn Manson song or album. I'm never a big Marilyn Manson fan.
No. Honest, but if I was, we would play that song.
Yeah, that'd be good. I'm sure everyone would really enjoy that. But anyways, In flagrante delicto, we thought that'd be a good one to bring up today, because it refers to that those incidents when, you know, somebody walks in and the guy is standing there kind of holding the corpse with a bloody knife in his other hand. That is being caught in flagrante delicto. That obviously was not the case in the Donald Marshall Jr.
No, quite
instance. They didn't catch him red-handed. In fact, he didn't commit the crime, but...
Quite the... It is very similar. Quite the antithesis in terms of its application, but the injustice is all the same, or the effect is still the same. The fact that it seems that, well, the commission stated that the entire criminal justice system was caught with their pants down, flagrantly violating someone's rights, and causing them a huge, huge injustice to their own benefit.
Yeah, they were caught in the very act of not doing their job.
Yeah, basically.
So there you go. In flagrante delicto.
In flagrante
delicto. Try and use
delicto.
It in sentence every once in a while.
In flagrante delicto.
And just in case anyone really has a passion for Latin legal maxims, there's a great Wikipedia page out there, Latin legal terms. And you can just go all night.
And you could ask Jay how to pronounce them.
And think of me when you're doing that.
Yes, yes. Think of Jay in flagrante delicto.
And that's it. That's the end of the Latin legal segment for the day.
And that is the end of Loopholes, I think, for this week. That has been, So we hope you've enjoyed it. Send us a message. Get in touch with us. tru.loopholes@gmail.com. You can also email the station, radio@tru.ca, to talk about anything. Send a compliment or a criticism of any sort. We accept both. You're listening to 92.5 FM.
Stay tuned for Backstreet Blues.
Yes, stay tuned for Backstreet Blues. This has been Chris.
I'm Jay.
For Loopholes. See you next week.
Bye.